Hello, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. This will be the 20th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, and today we're going to continue our story relating to the antibiotics. I'm going to primarily discuss the protein synthesis inhibitors. So let's begin. Now, remember the central dogma, right, of molecular biology, where you basically start with DNA, okay? And then that DNA via the process of transcription is made into RNA. And then the RNA via the process of translation is made into protein. And there are certain raw materials you do in fact need for translation, right? So you need like tRNA that has on the 3' end, it has the amino acid, and then it also has the anticodon, right, that pairs up with mRNA. The second raw material you need for the synthesis of proteins, right? You need the ribosome. In bacteria, which is what we're trying to target today, right? We have a large subunit, that's the 50S subunit, and a small subunit, that's the 30S subunit. And that together forms the 70S subunit. Contrast with humans that have a 60 and a 40S that makes up the 80S ribosome. And then we need an actual mRNA, right? Which was made by the process of transcription. So mRNA from the 5' to 3' end, right, it's loaded onto like the EP and A side of the ribosome, right? And the thing is, the first tRNA, you should hopefully know that it goes to the P site, okay? And the first amino acid that's classically made in bacteria is a methionine, a formylated methionine, okay? In fact, FMET is something known as a PAMP in the world of immunology. It's a pathogen-associated molecular pattern. It's something that's not found in humans, right? So it's something that our innate immune system recognizes to go after these nasty bugs. So the P site, right? So let me just hone in on some of these high-yield sites and just give a very quick overview of the pharmacology before going to the specific drug details. But the P site has 50 and 30 subunits that contribute to it, okay? And the thing is, if you work at the P site as an antibiotic, you're inhibiting initiation. So the 50S contribution to the P site is inhibited by linezolid, okay? We'll talk about it. It's a drug used to treat MRSA and VRE. It's an oral medication. Alternatively, the 30S contribution to the P sites can be inhibited with the aminoglycosides, right? So like your gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, and streptomycin. Now, in regards to the A site, right, there are drugs that inhibit that A site. And if you're an A site inhibitor, it should make sense that you inhibit the elongation step of protein synthesis, okay? And for the 30S contribution to the A site, that inhibition is done by your tetracyclines. Remember, unlike your aminoglycosides that are bactericidal, your tetracyclines are bacteriostatic, okay? Now, for the 50S contribution to the A site, the drugs that inhibit that site are your streptogramins, like dalfopristin, quinopristin. They cover MRSA. We'll talk about those later. And then for clindamycin, erythromycin, I'll sort of discuss those together. Clindamycin is in a different drug class from erythromycin. Erythromycin is a macrolid, okay? But your macrolids and clindamycin in general, they bind to the 50S subunit and basically prevents movement along the messenger RNA, right? So you're basically inhibiting translocation, okay? Translocation is one of the sub-steps in the elongation step of protein synthesis in translation. Now, peptidotransferase, right, it's this high-yield enzyme that forms bonds between amino acids during the process of translation. That enzyme is inhibited by chloramphenicol, okay? So chloramphenicol inhibits peptidotransferase. It's a 50S inhibitor. The only 30S inhibitors that are protein synthesis inhibitors are your aminoglycosides, which are bactericidal, and your tetracyclines, which are bacteriostatic. And the mnemonic, right, you'll probably hear this as you're studying for your USMLE exams, but buy at 30 and sell at 50. Okay, so the at 30, aminoglycosides and tetracyclines are 30S inhibitors. And then the sell at 50, right? So like CCELL, right? So like clindamycin, chloramphenicol, erythromycin, and other macrolides, linezolid, and I believe the lincosamides. Okay, so your aminoglycosides, right? So let's get a little more granular with these drugs. And the thing is, again, I'm not going to just give you drug names to memorize. The step one loves to integrate material with multiple fields. So I'll talk about like the different ways these drugs are tested on exams and then provide you the drug names. So the aminoglycosides, right? So they include drugs like gentamicin, okay, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, and streptomycin. They all end in mycin, okay? And they are bactericidal, right? And one of the mechanisms they have is that they cause misreading of mRNA. If mRNA is not read properly, you make bad proteins, and it so happens that those bad proteins, they poke holes in the cell membrane. And by poking holes in the cell membrane, right, if you think back to cell injury that you've probably learned as you're studying pathoma or whatever pathology resource you use, you'll see that when the cell membranes become permeable, that can cause death, right? Because that can cause cellular death, because all the cell soup is spilling out into the surroundings. So these drugs are bactericidal, okay, and I've talked about how they work. They're 30S inhibitors. Now, the drug names, again, gentamicin is here. Neomycin is another big one, okay? It's classically tested in the context of, like, PrEP before bowel surgery, because it's very good at killing off gram-negatives. As you'll find out, aminoglycosides cover primarily gram-negatives. They do not. Very high yield to know that. They do not cover gram-positives. They cover only gram-negatives. Okay, and the thing is, neomycin can actually be used in the setting of hepatic encephalopathy, because it's pretty good at killing off gram negatives, and one of the big constituent bugs in your GI tract are gram negative rods, so those are covered very nicely with neomycin. Another drug you can use for that hepatic encephalopathy purpose is rifaximin. It's an RNA polymerase inhibitor, again, that is pretty good at killing off your GI flora. So you may say, Divine, come on, how do these drugs help in hepatic encephalopathy? The thing is, the bugs in your GI tract make a ton of ammonia, okay? And the thing is, the GI tract, with the exclusion of the stomach, is primarily basic. So ammonia is pretty soluble. So it's actually reabsorbed in the GI tract. So one thing you could do is you could say, okay, let me try to take care of the source of the ammonia. Just kill off all the bugs with rifaximin, RNA polymerase inhibitor, or neomycin, aminoglycoside. Okay, so that's how those work in the setting of hepatic encephalopathy. Remember, you could also give lactulose for that purpose, right? You'll make lactic acid, acidify ammonia, you poop it out as ammonium ions. Okay, now amikacin is another aminoglycoside. Tobramycin, the big context they test this with is patients that have cystic fibrosis. Remember, patients with CF, classically when they're less than 21, the most common cause of respiratory infections there is Staph aureus. But as they become greater than 21, you're going into the territory of Pseudomonas. Okay, Pseudomonas, you can prophylax against that in a CF patient by giving the inhaled form of tobramycin. Okay, again, because Pseudomonas is a gram-negative rod, so it's covered very well by your aminoglycosides. Streptomycin is another low-yield aminoglycoside. It's used to treat, like, drug-resistant TB. Now, again, I said these drugs, they cover gram-negatives primarily, including Pseudomonas. The thing is, these drugs do not cover anaerobes, because they actually need oxygen to get into a cell. So aminoglycosides have no coverage against anaerobes. And one classic thing they test, and this is probably more step two territory, are GI cocktails for the treatment of, basically like antibiotic cocktails for the treatment of GI infections. One cocktail that includes the aminoglycosides is the MAG cocktail. I'm just making that word up, MAG, M-A-G, just to help you remember, metronidazole, ampicillin, and gentamicin. Okay, and you do this because the gentamicin and ampicillin cover gram negatives pretty well. Metronidazole helps you cover the anaerobes. Okay, another classic GI cocktail is like Cipro, so ciprofloxacin, your fluoroquinolones, and metronidazole. Again, Cipro, it's a fluoroquinolone, very good gram negative coverage. Okay, metronidazole helps you cover the anaerobes, right? So if you get a question about a patient that has like diverticulitis or cholecystitis, and they're asking for a recommendation on an antibiotic regimen, you want to pick either the MAG regimen of Metro, ampicillin and gentamicin, or the Cipro plus metronidazole regimen. And another high yield thing with the aminoglycosides is they have some nicotinic receptor blocking activity. Okay, remember, these nicotinic receptors, you find them at three high yield spots in the body, right? So you find them at the neuromuscular junction. Okay, you'll find those on the cell membranes of the postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system, and also the parasympathetic nervous system, right? But in addition, you also find these receptors on the surfaces of chromaffin cells. Remember, chromaffin cells are they're part of the adrenal medulla. They're kind of modified postganglionic sympathetic neuron, okay? But they release epinephrine primarily because they express PNMT. So, aminoglycosides, they can actually worsen neuromuscular blockade, right? So, if a person is getting a neuromuscular blocking agent, you probably want to be careful with administering aminoglycosides in that population. Now, what are the side effects of aminoglycosides, right? So, they are nephrotoxic. In fact, it's probably one of the most common causes of intrarenal azotemia, right? So, like an intrarenal acute renal failure picture. Your aminoglycosides are very nasty to cranial nerve 8, okay? So, actually, you can apply this in the setting of Meniere's disease, right? So, remember Meniere's disease with a triad of vertigo, tinnitus, and hearing loss. The pathophysiology there is like endolymphatic hydrops, right? So you have like hydropic swelling of the of like from too much endolymph in your ear apparatus, right? So those people complain of ear fullness, and then they have like vertigo, tinnitus, and hearing loss. You can actually treat that. Usually you try like a salt restricted diet, you try like a diuretic, but if that doesn't work, symptoms are refractory, you can inject gentamicin into the ear. Okay, so you can give gentamicin for that, an intra like auricular injection, and that can basically terminate the Meniere's disease. Okay, and you also want to know your mechanisms of resistance to your aminoglycosides. Don't forget, right? So if BOG encodes a transferase enzyme, like an acetyltransferase, by adding that chemical group to the aminoglycoside, the drug becomes inactivated. Okay, and also many BOGs express porins. These porins like actively cause the aminoglycosides to be extruded from the cells, or certain BOGs also have mechanisms to prevent the aminoglycosides from getting in. Okay, so those are your big mechanisms of resistance with the aminoglycosides. So now let's go to the next group. Okay, so from we've talked about the first 30S aminoglycosides, let's talk about the tetracyclines, right? So the tetracyclines, they're 30S inhibitors, they are bacteriostatic. Okay, remember they act at the A site. Okay, the 30S contribution to the A site, right? So they inhibit elongation. And the big drug names you want to remember here, right? So they all end in cycline, like demeclocycline, minocycline, doxycycline, tigecycline. Tigecycline, I'll just say one word about this. It's a tetracycline that has the ability to cover MRSA. So it's one of those things you want to file away in your brain somewhere. It's one of the more new generation tetracyclines. It belongs to the drug class known as the glycycyclines. Now, what do these tetracyclines cover? So they cover chlamydia pretty well, okay? So you can use that for the treatment of UTIs. They cover Borrelia burgdorferi, right? Remember, that's the causative agent of Lyme disease. Okay, remember, it's carried by the Ixodes tick. Don't forget for your exams that the Ixodes tick, in addition to carrying Borrelia burgdorferi that causes Lyme disease, it also carries Babesia microti, okay? Remember that Maltese cross pattern in red blood cells. It can present as a hemolytic anemia. And remember, the Ixodes tick also carries anaplasma, okay? So anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and Lyme disease can be caused by a bite from the Ixodes tick. Your tetracyclines also cover Rickettsia rickettsii. Remember, it's one of the causes of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, okay? Remember the rash on the palms and soles, okay? Remember the other causes of a rash on the palms and soles, right? So like secondary syphilis, Kawasaki's disease, Coxsackie A virus with hand-foot-mouth disease, okay? And again, Rickettsia rickettsii. And actually, in Rocky Mountain spotted fever, this is actually one of the exceptions where you can give a tetracycline to a kid that's less than 80 years old. In general, the overwhelming majority of the time, if a kid is less than 8 years old, they should not be getting a tetracycline. But if the disease they have is Rocky Mountain spotted fever, you usually take exception to that because RMSF is pretty fatal, right? So you want to treat it really well, and tetracyclines cover that bug extremely well. Okay. Now, alternatively, though, you could give chloramphenicol for Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Remember, chloramphenicol is a peptidotransferase inhibitor. In fact, I'll say in general, in pregnant women that have Rocky Mountain spotted fever, usually the go-to drug is chloramphenicol. Okay, usually chloramphenicol. Now, your tetracyclines, they also cover Vibrio species, right? So you can use them for like Vibrio cholerae. You can use them for Vibrio parahemolyticus and vulnificus. Remember, those cause a watery diarrhea. Vulnificus is particularly bad in people that have like liver disease, okay? Your tetracyclines also cover Propionibacterium acnes, right? So the causative organism in acne. They also cover H. pylori. In fact, H. pylori has two kinds of therapies, right? There is triple therapy, that's usually first line. And then there's quadruple therapy. So triple therapy, you can remember it with a CAP mnemonic, right? So CAP. So C for clarithromycin, that's a macrolide. A is for amoxicillin. We talked about that in the previous podcast. And then the P is for a PPI like omeprazole, okay? But if that doesn't work, you can consider using quadruple therapy. And that's where your tetracyclines come into play, right? So it's a MBTP, right? So M for metronidazole, B for bismuth, subsalicylate. The T is for the tetracycline, and then the P is for the PPI, okay? So that's quadruple therapy. Now, so your tetracyclines do in fact cover H. pylori, okay? And again, like I've said, they are contraindicated in kids that are less than 8 years old. And one thing about the tetracyclines is that they are bound very strongly by divalent ions. So you generally don't want to take a tetracycline with milk, right? Because milk contains calcium and magnesium ions. Those can bind up the tetracycline and it's not reabsorbed in the GI tract. But an interesting parallel to this is bones and teeth contain a lot of divalent ions, right? So they are very good at chelating tetracyclines. So if you bind up these tetracyclines, you can sort of imagine, you can sort of like stretch your thinking to imagine that this is potentially how tetracyclines cause a tooth discoloration, okay? And they also inhibit bone growth. Again, that's why you don't give them to moms that are pregnant or kids that are less than 8 years old. So tetracyclines, right? Another big one is demeclocycline. It actually inhibits the activity of ADH at the principal cell of the collecting duct, okay? So demeclocycline can actually cause nephrogenic diabetes insipidus as a side effect. You can actually take advantage of that in the treatment of SIDH, right? So in SIDH, you're reabsorbing too much water because you have too much ADH on board. So you can use the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus side effect off demeclocycline to treat SIDH. Remember, for SIDH, you can also use an ADH receptor antagonist, your Vaptans, like Conivaptan or Tolvaptan. Okay, now, linezolid is the next drug I'll talk about. It's a 50S inhibitor. It belongs to a drug class known as the oxazolidinones. Okay, you don't need to know that for step one. But it's a 50S inhibitor. It's bacteriostatic. Okay, it's a P-site inhibitor, right? So it inhibits the 50S contribution to the P-site. So, what does this drug cover, right? The big things you want to know for your exam is it covers MRSA and VRE. That's essentially all you need to know about linezolid. And it actually is a relatively clean drug. It's actually pretty expensive, though. If you've ever heard of Zyvox, that's linezolid. It's a relatively clean drug, and many clinicians like it because it's an oral medication that can treat MRSA, okay? Instead of giving like vancomycin. Vancomycin is only available in general as an IV formulation, although you could use oral vancomycin in the treatment of C. diff. Okay, so relatively few side effects, but there's one that has started making its way to USMLE exams, and that's the fact that linezolid can trigger serotonin syndrome when you give it with another serotonergic agent like St. John's wort or sumatriptan or your other triptans that are used for migraines, or an SSRI or an SNRI or an MAOI or tricyclic antidepressant. Okay, so the pathophysiology behind that is that linezolid actually has some weak monoamine oxidase inhibiting activity. So because it can inhibit monoamine oxidase, it can boost your levels of serotonin, and again, it can trigger serotonin syndrome. Now, the next drug I'll talk about here is clindamycin. Okay, it's a 50S inhibitor. Remember, I said it inhibits translocation, just like your macrolides. Okay, and it's bacteriostatic, and the coverage of clindamycin is actually high. You ought to know. You want to know that it covers MRSA really well. Okay, in fact, clinda is used very commonly for MRSA skin infections like cellulitis, for example. It's also pretty good at covering anaerobes. Classically, it covers anaerobes above the diaphragm, but that's a farce. It also covers anaerobes below the diaphragm. That doesn't really make much sense. But just classic teaching is anaerobes above the diaphragm, right? So that's why it's used for aspiration pneumonias, right? So if they describe a person that has pneumonia with foul-smelling sputum, you probably want to think about an anaerobic cause of that pneumonia, okay? You want to go ahead and cover that with clindamycin. And remember the high-yield anaerobes that pop up every so often on USMLE exams, right? There's Bacteroides, okay, B. fragilis. There's Fusobacterium species, okay? And then there's Peptostreptococcus, okay? I dare you to say that 10 times without flinching. Okay, Peptostreptococcus. Now, clindamycin on exams has classically been associated with causing C. diff, okay? Because it kills off your GI flora, including the anaerobes, so C. diff can overgrow, okay? So you can get into trouble with that. And how do you treat C. diff colitis, right? You generally treat it with metronidazole. We'll talk about that in a different podcast. You can also treat it with oral vancomycin because vancomycin is not reabsorbed. So you give it orally, stays in the GI tract, kills off the C. diff. If nothing works, you could also consider giving fidaxomicin. Fidaxomicin is one drug that inhibits RNA polymerase. It's used in the treatment of C. diff, but it's one of like your last line meds. But if all that stuff doesn't work, you can then consider trying a fecal transplant. Okay. Now, real quick, I'll just go ahead and reel off the, because I've been mentioning so many RNA polymerase inhibitors, so I think it probably makes sense to just reel them off right now, so you can sort of remember all of them as a group. Fidaxomicin is one, okay, it's used to treat C. diff colitis. Ribavirin, right, is another, okay, remember ribavirin is used to treat hep C. You can also use it to treat RSV, although that's kind of controversial. Although, don't forget that ribavirin also has another mechanism of action as an inhibitor of inosine monophosphate dehydrogenase, okay, which is the enzyme that's also inhibited by mycophenolate mofetil. Then rifampin, that's used to treat TB, right? Remember the RIPE regimen is also an RNA polymerase inhibitor. And then if you're going more into the world of toxicology, if you're consuming mushrooms, like deadly mushrooms for some reason, alpha-amanitin is an RNA polymerase inhibitor as well. Now, the next drugs I'll talk about are your streptogramins, right? Like quinupristin, dalfopristin, they bind to the A site. They basically inhibit the 50S contribution to the A site. Remember, I said the 30S contribution to the A site is inhibited by your tetracyclines. The 50S contribution is inhibited by your streptogramins, okay? And these drugs are actually bactericidal, okay? They inhibit elongation, right? Because again, if you bind to the A site, you're inhibiting elongation. I talked about the mechanism behind that earlier. And the drug names here again, quinupristin, dalfopristin, and the big coverage you want to know, in fact, probably the only coverage you need to know for any exam is MRSA. These drugs cover MRSA. Now, chloramphenicol, it's a 50S inhibitor, right? I already said it inhibits peptidyl transferase. Remember, this is the enzyme that basically forms peptide bonds between the amino acid chains that you find in the P site and the amino acid that's just coming in the A site, okay? And this drug, it so happens that it's cleared by phase 2 metabolism in the liver, right? So what's the poster child enzyme for phase 2 metabolism in the liver? That's UDPGT, right? So UDP, glucuronosyl transferase, okay, UDPGT. So when a kid is born, I mean, this enzyme is found pretty aggressively in adults, but when a kid is born, they have very little of this, okay? In fact, this enzyme generally is not induced until a kid is born, right? So it's something you generally don't have in utero. So when a kid is born, they have very low levels of this. That's why, again, you generally want to, like, not give chloramphenicol to newborn, okay, because of this UDPGT problem. So what are the bad side effects with chloramphenicol, right? So one bad side effect is aplastic anemia, okay? It can cause severe bone marrow suppression, right? So a classic exam scenario here will be like a kid that has been on chloramphenicol or some drug. They may not say chloramphenicol, but they may say kid has been on some drug for Neisseria meningitis, okay, in a developing country, because chloramphenicol is actually pretty commonly used in developing countries. And then they say the person starts having like worsening fevers, the person's O2 sats are dropping, and then they say you do like a bone marrow biopsy or whatever, and you get a dry tap. Well, like, I guess more bone marrow aspiration, you get a dry tap, or they could show you like a bone marrow histologic image and you see lots and lots and lots of fat cells. If you see that, think about the aplastic anemia from chloramphenicol, okay? It crosses the blood-brain barrier very well, so it's very good for the treatment of meningitis, okay? Because it also covers gram-negatives supremely well. Another high yield side effect of chloramphenicol is Gray BB syndrome. Okay, it's a lipid soluble agent, right? So it can deposit in the brain, deposit in other tissues. Okay, and again, it happens because neonates have a UDPGT deficiency. Okay, so it's a physiologic, right? It's something that they build up with time, but initially they have this deficiency, so they can't clear the drug really well. Okay, so they can get toxicity from the drug. An unusual way you can actually test this UDPGT business with the context of an adult or like an older kid is in the context of a person that has like an actual UDPGT deficiency, right? So like Crigler-Najjar syndrome, like type 1 or type 2. Or like Gilbert's, right? So if a patient has like Gilbert's, in general it's asymptomatic, but let's assume they're like severely ill, septic in the ICU, you probably don't want to give them chloramphenicol as a drug, because when those people get sick, that UDPGT deficiency begins to become a little more symptomatic, okay? So you don't want to like compound their problems by giving them something bad like a chloramphenicol that depends on UDPGT for metabolism. And again, chloramphenicol covers many bugs really well. Covers gram positives, covers gram negatives. In fact, there's very little resistance to chloramphenicol, but the side effects just make it a very uncommon drug in clinical practice. It covers Neisseria meningitis, again, because I said, again, it crosses the blood-brain barrier. And again, it's the drug of choice. Very high yield to know this. It's the drug of choice for the treatment of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in pregnant women. Okay? Now, so you bar the Gray BB syndrome or whatever teratogenic effects come with chloramphenicol. Pregnant women with Rocky Mountain spotted fever get chloramphenicol. That's basically the only time chloramphenicol is ever used for any purpose in clinical practice, at least in the US. Now, your macrolides, they are 50S inhibitors, right? So the 50S subunit of the ribosome has a 23S So think of it as a subunit. The 23S subunit of the 50S subunit of the ribosome is what is specifically inhibited by macrolides, okay? And by binding to that subunit, the macrolides prevent translocation, okay? And I'll just go ahead and mention this now because I feel like this is the best place to slot this in. But that's actually the mechanism of resistance to macrolides. If you methylate that 23S part of the 50S subunit of the ribosome, you basically prevent the macrolides from binding, okay, and they lose their effectiveness. Now, the big things you want to, big drug names you want to remember for your macrolides are like azithromycin, they all end in romycin, right? So azithromycin, clarithromycin, erythromycin, oligomycin, right? And you may say, oh, macrolides, there's not much we use them for. There's actually a lot of things that are potentially exam testable with macrolides. So I'm going to talk about them right now. First thing is, these macrolides are cleared by the liver, okay? They're cleared by the liver, big deal. So if a person has liver dysfunction, maybe reduce the dose of macrolides that you give them. That's not a very testable factoid. But a testable one is their effect as motilin receptor agonists, okay? So motilin is a thing you find in the GI tract that activates motilin receptors, and it causes, it's prokinetic. It increases GI motility. So if a patient has diabetic gastroparesis, you can actually treat that with metoclopramide. That's a dopamine receptor antagonist, but you could also use erythromycin, motilin receptor agonist, to treat diabetic gastroparesis. In fact, this explains why GI upset is probably like one of the most common side effects with macrolides. Okay, erythromycin, a high yield thing with erythromycin. In fact, in general, erythromycin, you try to avoid it in like newborns, because the thing is, it can cause an intrahepatic cholestasis, okay? Because it can actually precipitate in bile as erythromycin estolate, okay? And that can cause intrahepatic cholestasis that will present as like elevations in alkaline phosphatase in a newborn, okay? And another thing with erythromycin, right, it's actually associated with an increased risk of pyloric stenosis, especially if you give it within the first like 8 weeks of life. Okay, I remember pyloric stenosis presents as non-bilious vomiting in a kid that's usually less than 8 to 12 weeks old on exams. Okay, you classically can diagnose it with an ultrasound. You see a target sign. I talked about those high yield radiological signs in I think like episode 26 of our podcast. Now, let me just go ahead and say this. Many times on exams, especially MBME exams, if you pay attention to age ranges, you can usually pick out the right answer or very quickly exclude wrong answers. The thing is, in general, if a kid is 1 year old, they cannot get pyloric stenosis on MBME exams, okay? Pyloric stenosis almost always shows up within the first 3 months of life. It's very high yield to know that, okay? So erythromycin, also being a firstborn male, right? Those all increase your risk of pyloric stenosis. Okay, now, the thing with the macrolides is they also have like some mild potassium channel blocking activity, okay? So they can actually prolong the QT interval and cause a torsade de Pointes, okay? Clarithromycin, I already talked about it in the context of triple therapy for H. pylori. Oligomycin is actually a macrolide, and I'm sure you may be like, where have I heard of oligomycin? Well, hopefully you've heard about it from reading the biochemistry chapter in First State, okay? Oligomycin is actually a macrolide that's used for research purposes. It inhibits ATP synthase complex 5, okay? So it's just one of those bizarre factoids you do want to memorize for step 1 especially. Now, what do these macrolides cover, right? So macrolides, they cover atypical bugs, right? So like, especially the atypical causes of pneumonia, like mycoplasma, chlamydia, and legionella, right? And an easy way to remember that is, if you spell out the word macrolide, it has an M, it has a C, and it has an L in the name, okay? Actually, one of the med students at my med school were the ones that have taught me this nice mnemonic there. So, covers MCL, mycoplasma, chlamydia, and legionella. Okay, they also cover vaccine preventable illnesses pretty well, right? As a general principle, like Rhinobacterium diphtheria, right? So if you see like bull's neck in an immigrant or a person from like California, like an anti-vaxxer person, think about potentially treating that with a macrolide. Okay, Rhinobacterium diphtheria, another high yield vaccine preventable illness, Bordetella pertussis, right? So like whooping cough, remember, it classically presents as a person that has like a nasty cough and then they have like inspiratory whoops, or They essentially never put that inspiratory whoops. Everyone has memorized that crap for exams, so they don't put that anymore. The thing they'll probably put is a person that has cough, and the cough is so severe that they vomit after the cough. Or they could say, oh, the person has cough, and then they have a subconjunctival hemorrhage. If you ever see that, think about Bordetella pertussis, okay? And remember, it's a bacterial infection. And usually, if a person has a bacterial infection, you respond to that bacterial infection by a proliferation of neutrophils, right? So your polymorphonuclear leukocytes. The thing is, Bordetella pertussis is actually typical in that respect. It's a bacterial infection that's accompanied by lymphocytosis. In fact, these people's white counts will go to like 70,000-80,000. Okay, that's another unique feature of Bordetella pertussis. And Bordetella pertussis, you treat this with, you should obviously get the vaccine to not have it in the first place. And I'll just say this right now, vaccines do not cause autism. Okay, good. So you could treat whooping cough with a macrolide, or you could prophylax, especially close contacts of a person that has whooping cough, you would prophylax with macrolides as well. Azithromycin is another macrolide, right? Remember, they can test this in the context of HIV/AIDS because it it covers Mycobacterium avium intracellulare, right? Remember, your magic number is a CD4 count less than 50. You want to go ahead and give azithromycin as prophylaxis against MAC. Now, I'll just go ahead and also say that the macrolides, they inhibit cytochrome P450, okay? Remember, your P450 inhibitors and inducers are high-yield things you want to know for your exam. The inhibitors, right? So there's this mnemonic you've probably read in many resources, right? The crack amigos mnemonic, right? So like the P450 inhibitors, right? So like ciprofloxacin and your fluoroquinolones, that's the C. Ritonavir, remember, that's a protease inhibitor. Talk about that in a different podcast. Amiodarone, the class 3 antiarrhythmic. Cimetidine, it's a H2 receptor blocker. It's used to treat peptic ulcer disease. Remember, it also has androgen receptor blocking activity, so it can cause gynecomastia. The K for ketoconazole, that's an azole. It's an antifungal medication. Acute alcohol use, okay, actually inhibits CYP450. Contrast that with chronic alcoholism, that actually induces cytochrome P450. Okay, your macrolides, as I already mentioned, are also inhibitors. That's the M of CYP450. Isoniazid, that's one of your TB drugs, okay, inhibits CYP450. Grapefruit juice or omeprazole, right, that's your O, and other PPIs, they also inhibit CYP450, and also your sulfonamides. Remember, those are dihydroptheric synthase inhibitors. I'll talk about that when I talk about Bactrim. Okay, your P450 inducers, right? So don't forget your the mnemonic there is like Guinness, Coronas, and PBRs induce chronic alcoholism, right? So like Guinness, the G is a griseofulvin, Coronas, carbamazepine, that's an anti-seizure medication that's also used to treat trigeminal neuralgia, or Tic Doloureux. That's an inducer of cytochrome P450. PBRs, right? So the P stands for phenytoin. Remember, that has zero order metabolism. And then the B stands for the barbiturates, right? So remember, those are GABA receptor agonists. There's no rescue agent for those. The R stands for rifampin. Remember, that's an RNA polymerase inhibitor that's used to treat TB. So PBRs, the S stands for St. John's wort, okay? It's one of those herbal supplements that has some mild SSRI activity. So it's used to treat depression. You can induce, say, P450. And classically on exams, these P450 inducers, they test them in the context of birth control. Like a lady that's taking birth control and one of these other agents, and then she becomes pregnant because she's getting reduced effectiveness of the birth control pills. So Guinness, Coronas, PBRs induce chronic alcoholism, right? So chronic alcoholism also induces cytochrome P450. Contrast that with, again, with acute alcoholism that inhibits cytochrome P450. So I think this has gone on long enough. I think that's all I want to say about the protein synthesis inhibitors. The next time we meet in a different podcast episode, I'll go into like the TB meds, the sulfonamides, and some other like high yield drugs like the fluoroquinolones and polymyxins and blah blah blah. Okay, so have a wonderful rest of the day. I hope you're enjoying your Sunday, and this, I believe, is the first day of the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm a Cleveland Cavaliers supporter, so I hope they win. I wish you the best rest of the day. Have a wonderful week ahead, and God bless. Thank you.